Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Over time, real food prices go up and they go down. But right now, we're at the end of a long period of cheap food. Globally, prices are soaring, and experts disagree over when and if they'll come down again this time. There have been riots, food stampedes. American farmers are sitting pretty on high prices. But where are we headed here? This hour, On Point, we'll look at the implications of a soaring global grocery bill and the new factors behind the rising price of food. Joining me first today from London is John Parker. He's globalization correspondent for The Economist magazine. He's been closely following the rise in global food prices. He wrote the cover story, The End of Cheap Food. John Parker, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
Give us a couple of the key numbers here, if you'd be good enough. What are the indicators? What are the proof points that food prices, if you haven't felt it at the grocery store already, that they're headed up?
The sort of basic wheat price went over $10 a bushel this week. A couple of years ago, it was $5 a bushel. It's gone up by something like 20% in the last week. It's gone up by something like 50% this year. The Economist has been running its own food index since 1850. In real terms, our index fell by about 75% in the 30 years up to 2005. Since 2005, it's gone up by about that same amount. It's gone up 75%. So the basic pattern has been that in about 2005, food prices started really to rise quite sharply, and this year they've just gone nuts.
I'm looking here at a list of average retail food prices in U.S. cities. This is from the Wall Street Journal. It shows eggs up 37.8%, whole milk up 30%, iceberg lettuce 16%, cheddar cheese 12%, whole wheat bread 11.9% or 12%. I mean, those are the spikes in what's not that big a rise overall. Nevertheless, those are the kind of eye-popping numbers. Are the food price rises consistent globally? Are they rising faster at higher some places than others? Paint
They're
that for us.
Pretty though. Consistent across the board. I mentioned wheat. The rice price is its highest for something like 25 years. Corn, soybeans, you name it. And this is unusual. I would say it's very unusual. You often get spikes. You know, the wheat harvest fails in a big producer like Argentina or Australia, and the price goes up, and then next year, you know, you return to normal and the price comes down. This happens all the time. Prices of agricultural commodities are very volatile. It's exceptionally unusual for them all to be at or near their peaks, at or near their all-time highs. But that's the situation now. So it's been going up for quite a while. You use the word spike. I think the jury's out on that. I mean, a spike implies it's going to come, you know, crashing down.
It's sort of a word like surge.
Yes. We've certainly seen the left-hand side of the spike, that is the upward movement.
Yep.
And I do think probably we will see some downward movement over the next couple of years. But I am quite skeptical of the notion that it's a spike in its fullest sense. That is to say, you know, in a couple of years' time, we'll be back to where we were in 2005.
Well, explain that then. Explain that, John Parker. If we normally say what comes up must come down, and it would apply to food prices as well. But if it's headed up, if they're headed up, and they may stay up at substantially higher than they were, what are the new structural factors that are pushing them up and may hold food prices up globally?
The big one is the growing wealth of India and China and kind of the middle classes all around the world. As a basic rule, grain prices have been related to population growth, and population, not population itself, population has been going up, but the rate at which population has been going up has been coming down. So you know, the population growth has been evening out, and we're still growing
70 million people a year, but okay,
right.
Yeah.
Right. So that kind of what you might call the old driver of agricultural, of grain prices is no longer what it was. Meat prices, on the other hand, seem to be related to economic growth. You know, if the country's growing at like 5 or 7% a year, meat demand goes up by 5 to 7% a year.
And people in China, I'm reading here, eating more than twice the amount
right.
of meat that they ate just
as
a few years ago.
As people get wealthier, they shift from their old grain-based diets to more meat. And compared with, say, the mid-80s, the Chinese are eating more than twice as much meat as they used to.
Mm.
So essentially what's happened in the kind of big picture, if you look back over 30 years, what used to be related to population growth, which has been leveling off,
mm-hmm.
is now related to economic growth, which is, you know, despite the problems we're seeing in the world economy at the moment, mm-hmm. despite that, economic growth is still pretty strong in the really huge countries like India and China with 1 billion people. So there's this underlying 1 or 2%, you know, ratcheting increase mm. in demand for grains every year. It's been going on and on and on, and it's sort of tightening the grain supplies.
They're eating more meat. More meat means
yeah.
a lot more grain required,
yes.
and so up goes the price. You're also looking at biofuels and the grains, particularly corn in the United States,
right.
being diverted or planted to turn into fuel for cars and trucks and all the rest.
Right. The thing about the sort of the shift into meat, that's been going on and on for decades, really. So it can explain the general tightening, but it can't explain why something happened in 2005. And the most likely explanation, in my view, of that is that the American government essentially changed the ethanol program in 2005 to encourage it. And an enormous amount of the American corn crop is now going into ethanol supplies. And something of the order of half the change in the grain stocks
mm-hmm.
Is accounted. That is to say, you know, the grain stocks is like a very general indicator of the excess of demand over supply, and half of that excess is accounted for by the amount of corn that's going into ethanol. So, you know, an enormous amount. We're not exactly sure how much, something of the order of 80 million tons, which used to go to feed cattle, is now going essentially into SUVs. And so that's been taken off the market and has driven the price, means that their supply is lower than it was, demand's still high. So the supply and demand balance has changed pretty substantially since 2005, and that's why the price has gone shooting up relatively recently.
Well, John,
that's not the sole reason,
right.
many other reasons, but it's a big reason.
All countries produce food, many produce grain. How big a deal is it for the global food economy, if we can speak of such a thing, when the United States changes its policy dramatically, whether it's for biofuels or any other reason?
The U.S. is the world's biggest single agricultural exporter, if you know, take them all together. I think it's the world's biggest exporter, both of soybeans and corn. It's a very big wheat exporter. It's just, you know, it's the giant. It's the elephant in the room. And so when it used to export an enormous amount and it no longer does so, that makes a difference to everybody.
In 2000, you report 15 million tons of America's corn crop was turned into ethanol. In, 2007? That might have been 85 million tons.
Yeah.
Are there other countries that can pick up the slack or step in and begin producing if the United States starts to turn more of its corn toward ethanol? I don't know, does Brazil or somebody else, are there new, is there just new earth to be tilled that's not tilled at the moment?
Brazil does produce an enormous amount of ethanol. It produces it out of sugar. And that could do a great deal, except that the U.S. keeps up tariff barriers against Brazilian ethanol. And so the Brazilians can produce as much of it as they want, but they can't sell any of it to the US. So that's not going to make an enormous amount of difference, at least to the US.
But what about for the global food market? Can we go on feeding the global population? And what does global warming factor in here? Is that going to add arable land or subtract it from what's available?
Huge debate about that. There is a great deal of land which could be taken into, which could be taken under the plow. But it would probably, one's talking about like 20 or 30 years' time for a big increase. So, for example, to stay in Brazil, Brazil has kind of more or less three, I'm exaggerating here, but more or less three types of land. You know, it's got the kind of land under the crops now, then there's the land which is currently grazed by the cattle, and then there's the Amazon. And it could take land currently grazed by the cattle under crops and crop it much more intensively. The worry about that would be, of course, that where would the cattle go? And the worry would be that they would go onto the Amazon. So there's a sort of knock-on worry. But there is quite a lot of land in Brazil, in Kazakhstan, in Russia, which could be much more intensively farmed than it is now. And what that would probably require is a great deal of more fertilizer use than it currently gets at the moment. It sort of basically it's kind of quite dry land that just lies fallow. If you tilled it a lot, if you fertilized it, that could make a big difference. Kind of problem at the moment is fertilizer is very, you know, it's mostly, it's a petrochemical, made of oil. Oil prices are very high, so fertilizer use is very expensive.
And round we go, but maybe onto a higher plateau of food prices, and maybe for a long time. John Parker with The Economist, you're terrific. Thank you very much for joining us from London.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about food inflation, the soaring cost globally of what we eat, what's driving it, where it's headed, and the end of the era of really cheap food. I'm joined by two food economists. We go first to Rome and Andolreza Abbasian, senior economist at the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. Mr. Abbasian, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for the invitation.
And we go to Ames, Iowa, and Bruce Babcock, professor of economics and director of the Center for Agriculture and Agricultural and Rural Development at Iowa State University. Mr. Babcock, professor, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Great to have you both with us. First to you, Mr. Abbasian, in Rome, you watch the global picture here. I've seen you quoted saying we do not have a crisis. Then what do we have? How do you read what's going on with food?
Right. Well, you know, FAO is a It's an agricultural organization. We are watching the world situation very closely. Yes, we have said we don't have a world food crisis because that, to those who've been following the market for many decades, know what that could entail. What we have are a series of mini crises, especially in poorer countries where prices have jumped, and they have jumped up rather rapidly, and is the speed of which the prices increase that has been a real major concern. So we have heard of riots, we have heard of little revolts, and we have heard of many government interventions in many countries trying to somehow reduce the pressure of the high prices on consumers.
Bruce Babcock, you're there in the breadbasket country. Will Iowa and its neighbors in the United States and other big producing areas around the world just kick up their production, even out the scales of supply and demand, and the pressure comes off, the food price rises?
Well, that's what economic theory would tell us will happen. We're running a great experiment right now to see how responsive the world's producers and farming sectors are going to be, because they've never seen an incentive to produce more commodities than they're seeing right now. So in the next year, 2-3 years, with these high prices, which I think are probably with us to stay for that time period, I think we're going to see how productive or how responsive the world agriculture is going to be. I'm confident that we're going to see quite a bit of increased production, not only from the grain sector, but also from the dairy sector and other sectors as people adopt new technologies and increase their productivity.
Professor Babcock, remind us just how good it's been in the last year and more for farmers, let's say, in Iowa.
Well, I just did some calculation. One measure of how profitable crop farming is to look at the revenue minus the cost of production. Mm. And that margin has increased by about 150%. So it's more than doubled. It's almost tripled in the last 2 years. So that shows you what kind of incentive that farmers in all around the United States have to increase production.
Mr. Abazian, in Rome, we heard earlier from John Parker in London that he at The Economist magazine sees what may be structural changes around food supply and prices that keep prices up and maybe rising for a long time. The use of food grains for fuel, the rise of economies in China and India elsewhere, and meat consumption going along with that. Maybe even some crimp in global production capacity because of global warming. Do you see a danger that the market may not kick in the traditional way this time to bring and keep food prices down?
We don't see a danger. There is certainly a concern. The issue here is, first of all, whether we are having a structural change from this long time of decline in real prices. And I think that most analysts would agree that it's a bit too early call, as we just heard.
Mm-hmm.
Production responses shouldn't be undermined. We will certainly have that. The issue is that whether we're going to go back to the low prices we were used to, and I think there we could give a more definite answer and say perhaps not. It is likely that prices remain high. It may not be at the sort of highs we are experiencing in these months, but they may come down, but they're not going to come down perhaps significantly. And this is due to several factors, which we can discuss. But one thing I need to mention is that we have to be careful about short-term and distinguishing between the short-term events and the long-term events.
Mm-hmm.
This year, we had fundamentals which basically were very much negative and resulted in the very tight supply situation, and at the same time, we had the increase in demand.
Mm-hmm.
But the issue of emerging economies, China, India, these are not new developments. They've been there, and they're bound to stay there. Although in the long run, they are the main drivers on the demand side because basically they reflect the increases in population and in income, they are not responsible for the soaring prices that we are experiencing in this month.
Now, remind us of the difference between the effect of price increases in an affluent country and in a poorer country. Americans overall may have seen, 5% increase in the grocery bill in the last year. But when you have food increases in a poor country, 5% people sort of take into stride. But how does it hit, let's say, a family in a poorer country so much harder, Mr. Abazian?
Right. Now, this is exactly the kind of a concern we are trying to deal with these days because, as you said, in a developed country, a very little part of our saving, let's say, of our spending, goes into food. In the developing countries, especially poorer ones, it could be over 16% or even higher. So when prices rise there by even 10 or 20%, whatever, it's going to have a major implication for consumers. At the same time, you have this other problem that a lot of these poorer countries have a potential to produce and actually become, let's say, more self-sufficient, so they don't need to rely on expensive imports and so forth. But government's tasks are kind of difficult, how to make sure that prices domestically do not go up so that consumers who we just said, spend a lot of their money on food would not be hurt, and at the same time have enough incentives for farmers can produce, and therefore the country could actually also benefit, just like Iowa farmers, they could also benefit from the high prices, become efficient, invest, and so forth. It's a very serious paradox.
So maybe farmers in poor countries could benefit, but it hits the family budgets there first and hard. Bruce Babcock in Ames, Iowa, can American farmers feed the demand from American gas tanks and feed the world? Can we do both, even with the historically sort of famous productive capacity of American agriculture?
We can't feed all the gas tanks, but if you look at the new energy bill that just got passed through Congress and signed by President Bush, it basically puts a goal of feeding perhaps about 22% of the gas tank, and I think America
way up from what it was.
Huge commitment, from four to five percent where we are currently, up to perhaps 22%. And I think over between now and 2022, I think American agriculture can clearly meet that goal at essentially not increasing prices too much more. We got to remember that right now prices are such all-time high, and that American agriculture is going to increase the amount of land planted, it's going to increase the application of inputs, and it's going to increase production given normal weather. And so I think over time American agriculture can actually achieve that. The question becomes, in terms of moving forward, if we think if prices are going to come down significantly from today's levels, and I'm talking about oil seeds and corn and wheat and rice, we're going to have to see response not only from the United States but the rest of the world. And if you and I'm confident that if government policy encourages farmers and allows farmers to keep the profits that they can make from their production, that in fact you will see a quite a response from the farmers around the world.
In other words, more output, more production all over the place.
More output all over the place. And, you know, we as a society, United States, but in South America and in Europe, have to figure out, do we really want to take a big chunk of that production out of food production and fill our gas tanks with a modest amount, 10 to 20% of our fuel supply.
Still, 20%, not so small. Let's get a call from your neck of the woods. Jonathan is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Jonathan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to bring up a couple points of, we really need to look at what exactly we're doing with corn ethanol. Corn is a food product, and as of right now, the only way that we can produce corn ethanol is by using a very small amount of the actual crop. You're only using the kernel. Really, I think we need to expand our boundaries, and we really need to look at other crops that we could use, such as switchgrass. Switchgrass can be easily grown in Iowa. Extremely, extremely hardy plant that you can cut down to almost the root while harvesting it. And I think that this is a much better alternative than corn, because like we're discussing here with these rising prices in food and whatnot, the last thing we want to do is be taking food off the market and putting it into our gas tanks.
But so far it's all about corn, essentially, in the United States. Do you see that changing, Jonathan?
I really hope that it does change, because it's a big, big mistake. We're not seeing exactly how much we're paying for what we're doing. When we go to the gas tank and we see, okay, we have some corn ethanol in this, that's great. We're supporting, you know, renewable energy, or we're supporting whatever. Really, it's you're paying more than what you expect through government subsidies, through other taxes that are being implemented, so the true price is not coming out of the gas tank.
A lot of subsidy behind that. Jonathan, thanks for your call. Professor Babcock, do you see corn-based ethanol fading away if the U.S. turns more and more toward biofuels, or is it kind of baked in the cake by this legislation you talked about, by American farming patterns?
Well, we have I think we're going to be limiting the amount of corn ethanol at about 14 billion gallons, which is about double what we have today, by 2022. That's part of the new Energy Act, but I don't think it's going to go beyond that. The Energy Act also talks about 16 billion gallons from cellulosic material. And right now it appears that, in contrast to what the caller said about a perennial crop or a dedicated energy crop being planted, we got to remember that when we plant an energy crop, we're taking acres out of food crops. So it's not like you can just get this energy crop for nothing. I think what we're going to be focusing on actually is the residue from crops production, in this case corn. Half the weight of corn is cellulose. So I think what we're going to see in Iowa anyway is a harvesting of the cellulosic residue.
You mean the whole stalk, the cob, everything?
Everything, and we'll take the grain, we'll feed the cattle, we'll take the grain, make some corn ethanol, and we'll take the stalk and we'll make cellulosic biofuels.
Mr. Abbasi, in Rome, a final thought from you. How do you see American policy? It matters because the U.S. is such a big exporter. Does it look like the right policy in economic terms, in moral terms, when it comes to feeding the human population of this planet in a reasonable price and way?
Well, let's call it. It is U.S. has a critical role in that. Earlier, one of your guests mentioned the U.S. is the biggest producer, biggest exporter of the world market. On the other hand, let's put this in perspective. It is true that U.S. this year used a record amount of corn for ethanol, to tune up about 80, 85 million ton. But U.S. also managed to increase production of corn by basically increasing land planting by 18%. Just to give you an idea, the increase in the production in the U.S. was more than the entire amount of corn produced in EU 27, European Union. So we're talking about a huge potential in the U.S. It is not so much of a concern in the short term. I think that the issue is not so much of an issue in the sense that even you taking into account the latest energy bill, it seems that U.S. would be able to provide enough feedstock for its own ethanol plant and export and also fulfill its feed requirements. The big issue is elsewhere. Once we have a mandated policy like it is now in the U.S., we are basically going to move away from something that U.S. and many countries in the world are advocating, in fact, which is try to make sure farmers respond to prices. We are going to be in a situation where farmers feel protected. They will just produce because they know that there is this much of a mandate, this much will have to be taken into ethanol and so forth. And this may have a distorting impact. And, you know, we know what distortions mean. We are still trying to struggle to get out of, you know, try to make the WTO successful and so forth. So it may put us in another sort of a situation which in the long run become difficult to manage. Mm.
Abdulreza Abazian at the UN Food and Agriculture Organization in Rome, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for your invitation.
I want to bring another voice into our conversation, if I may, from Washington, D.C. Lester Brown is with us, environmental analyst, been following global sustainability issues for years. He's founder of the Earth Policy Institute. Lester Brown, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
How do you see the big picture of what's going on with food and food prices, Lester?
What I see is a situation where historically we had a food economy and we had an energy economy. Now the two are fusing because we have the capacity in the United States in particular to convert grain into oil. Well, actually grain into ethanol. Mm-hmm. But the what this means is that the price of grain is now keyed to the price of oil. Because if the food value of a commodity is less than the fuel value, the market will move that commodity into the energy economy. And this is what we're seeing around the world. If the price of oil goes from $80 a barrel to $100 a barrel, the price of grain will follow it up. If oil should go to $140 a barrel, the price of grain will follow it up. And this is what I don't think we've yet fully grasped. This emerging competition between cars and people for the world grain supply. The 860 million people who own cars want to maintain their mobility, and they don't much care where the fuel comes from. The 2 billion poorest people in the world simply want to survive, and they're finding it very difficult to compete with automobile owners, which is not surprising. According to some back-of-the-envelope calculations I did, the average income of automobile owners in the world is about $30,000 a year. The average income of the 2 billion poorest people in the world is less than $3,000 a year. So it's easy to see who's going to win in this competition.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about food inflation, the soaring cost globally of what we eat, what's driving it, where it's headed, and the end of the era of cheap food. Bruce Babcock joins us from Ames, Iowa, professor of economics at Iowa State University. And from Washington, D.C., Lester Brown, a big figure in the world of global sustainability issues and environment, founder of the Earth Policy Institute, author of many books, including most recently Plan B 3.0, Mobilizing to Save civilization. And Lester Brown, you were saying just before the break that you see grains going in essentially to gas tanks, the wealthy of the world sort of, being served by agricultural land, the 860 million who drive cars, let's say, the 2 billion poor getting the short end of the stick. But let me ask you this. You see a fundamental shift here with the price of food being tied to the price of energy or oil, if those become sort of fungible. So if we take food off the plates or out of the bowls of the poor and into gas tanks of the rich, well, if you make that linkage, won't food become so expensive that it will encourage all kinds of production in all kinds of places around the world? Shouldn't it even out somehow?
Well, you have to keep in mind that we're losing a lot of cropland each year in countries like China, even here in the United States, as a result of construction. The basic point in looking at this issue is to realize that from an agricultural point of view, the world demand for automotive fuel is insatiable. The grain it requires, for example, to fill an SUV 25-gallon tank with ethanol will feed one person for a year. Or looked at in the U.S. context, if we were to convert our entire grain harvest into fuel for cars, it would cover maybe 16% of our automotive fuel needs. So it's obviously not a solution. And we have mentioned climate as an issue, and I think it's sort of a wild card in the future food security deck of cards. Mm. I noticed that commodity analysts from time to time, when we're faced with a short crop, refer to when weather returns to normal. But the reality is there's no norm to return to now because the Earth's climate system is in a state of flux. The other thing that we have to think about in looking at the food future is the water situation. We drink close to 4 liters of water a day in one form or another, as water, as coffee, as juice, and what have you. But the water required to produce the food we consume each day is 2,000 liters or 500 times as much. Mm. Now, while most of the on-point listeners probably sense that the world is headed for a future of water shortages, most have not yet connected the dots to realize that a future of water shortages is also a future of food shortages. And this helps explain why in 7 of the last 8 years, world grain consumption has exceeded production. And that can happen only if you draw down stocks. So in drawing down stocks in 7 of the last 8 years, we now have carryover stocks of grain, the amount in the bin when the new harvest begins, at the lowest level in on record, down to just 54 days, which is not much more than pipeline supplies.
Mm. Bruce Babcock, there are some pretty big fundamentals that can sound daunting. Take the core linkage that Lester Brown is making between food prices now and fuel prices. He says that changes the economics around food in a way that may drive them away from billions of people who can't compete with automotive drivers for the outcome. You got a fundamental change there, he says.
Yeah, but it's not a fundamental economic change in that a lot of that linkage has been delivered by federal and government policies that have mandated that linkage. And so, for example, we subsidize ethanol blenders by giving them 51 cents a gallon for every gallon of ethanol they blend. That increases the corn price, essentially, their ability to pay for corn by about $1.50 a bushel. And so the New Energy Act in the United States has made a conscious decision to de-link energy prices and corn prices when corn ethanol gets above gets to 14 to 15 billion gallons. Now, of course, if the crude oil prices go to $140, then maybe you'll get that link again without government subsidy. But I think there's a lot of other things we need to worry about when if oil prices get to $150, there'll be a lot of other energy sources coming in as a backstop technology. So, in some sense, that link there is that link, but it really depends on government policy to sustain itself. And so I think you will see the politics work through itself. And, for example, the EU is already reconsidering its biofuels targets. I think the Congress has already limited the amount of corn that will be put into the gas tank, if you will. So I'm confident that if we see grain commodity prices go much higher than today, you're going to get a response from government limiting that linkage.
Lester Brown, do you think governments can maintain a firewall between energy prices and food prices?
They're not doing a very good job of it right now. We've been talking about wheat and corn and soybean prices hitting all-time highs, and the chances are that food prices are going to go much higher in 2008 than they were in 2007. I don't look at this as something that has happened. I look at it as something that is in process. And the bottom line risk is the social unrest and political instability in developing countries. Whereas when we buy food, it's usually processed, and the farmer's share of what we buy in the supermarket is typically 15 to 20% or so. Whereas in developing countries, people in Pakistan, where flour prices have doubled and wheat prices have more than doubled, buy wheat and then take it home and grind it into flour and make bread. Mm-hmm. So there's a very direct link between the world price of wheat and consumer prices in Pakistan or India or other developing countries.
And I'm reading in the news today that they've got paramilitary troops in Pakistan now protecting shipments of wheat because it's become so expensive and social unrest there is so high.
Yes, in fact, rising flour prices have eclipsed the assassination of Benazir Bhutto as a political issue in Pakistan. And the other thing to keep in mind, Tom, is that worldwide we're looking at a list of failing states that's getting longer each year now. Pakistan is one of those failing states, and it happens to be one with nuclear weapons. And for a lot of these countries, soaring grain and food prices could push them over the edge and lead to a breakdown of the social order of the sort that we're seeing in Somalia, Sudan, the Congo, Haiti, increasingly in Pakistan and many other countries. So the bottom line for me, the bottom line indicator is what's happening to the number of failing states in the world, and I think that's going to increase rather rapidly with the almost chaotic commodity prices in world markets.
Drawing a long line, or maybe not so long, from food prices to social and political realities, let's take a couple of calls. Katie in Bridgewater, Virginia. Katie, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. What do you see out there, Katie? What do you see at the supermarket?
I see the prices going up. I believe that I have an advantage because I live out, sort of in the country, and there are farms all around.
Mm-hmm.
I feel for the people in the city because they don't have the options I do. But what we've done is I now buy my milk and eggs from a local farmer. I buy most of my meat from a local farmer. And it's actually cheaper that way than it is in the store. I go in the store to get my produce and other things, and those prices are going sky high. When we have a family to feed,
mm-hmm.
and now when I go to put a salad together or something like that, I look around. I've got to make some choices of what not to get. Maybe we just won't have cucumbers this week on the salad. And we have to kind of adjust our priorities in the kitchen.
And that's in an American budget. Can you imagine if the price of food were 20% of your household budget, Katie?
Right. Well, I think we'd have to save more seeds. We have a backyard garden, and we don't really take it very seriously, but I think this year we'll take it a little more seriously.
Katie, good luck with that, and I hope you do, and thanks very much for your call. Let's get one more from Somerville, South Carolina. Janet, you're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to share some cutting-edge information with the audience. I am a sweet potato breeder, been one for 20 years, just got back from South Florida. Under old phosphate mine subsoils, we can produce sweet potatoes that can produce about 1,100 gallons per acre. Corn does 300. Switchgrass does 350. We have 36 million acres that we tell farmers in the United States that not to farm. We pay them to farm, not farm this acreage. We have old mines. We have old strip mines. We can grow crops like sweet potato and sweet sorghum that will sustainably produce ethanol with little water and very efficient on nitrogen.
So where are you going with this, Jen? Are you saying that sweet potatoes can solve our food price problem? We're going to have sweet potato tortillas, or that you'd prefer we put biofuel money into sweet potatoes? What?
There is no research money. That's the problem. We're shutting down our program at TVA that worked on biofuels. The new farm bill is only supporting research on cellulosic ethanol. We're not looking at the carbohydrate crops. China today is not building any more ethanol plants based on grain. They are being based on sweet potato, sorghum, and cassava.
So are you jealous of Iowa, where they're grain-rich as opposed to sweet potatoes?
No. Corn was never designed to be a fuel crop. It's designed to be a food crop. As a plant breeder, we need to design crops that can produce a whole lot of carbohydrate per acre than corn could ever do, which sweet potato and sorghum do, and are much more efficient in terms of nitrogen, water, and can even be grown under drought conditions. I had a test last year in Alabama where even under a 100-year drought, we produce more starch per acre, three times as much as corn.
Janet, we hear it, and it sounds like you're eager to get in on that. Let me get one more call, and we'll take it to Bruce Babcock in Iowa. But Matt first in Providence, Rhode Island. Matt, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. Yeah, I'm a farmer, but I'm not like most of the farmers that the economists keep talking about. So we have a small, sustainable farm. A lot of it's in the city of Providence. Very intensive. We grow as much stuff on that farm as our colleagues do on farms of 2 or 3 acres, or, you know, and if we had more land, we'd probably be growing huge amounts of food. But we're doing it organically and sustainably. Not hearing a lot about that, except for from the callers.
How does it factor in, Matt, to a global food price rise? Can you raise enough organically, locally, intensively to really impact food prices globally?
No, I can't. But when prices go up, that means that I'm getting a more fair shake for my produce. And if I'm getting a more fair shake, I can compete with prices in the supermarkets. And if I'm doing that, I'm small time. If other New England farmers can do that, other Indian farmers can do that, and they can expand their production in a good way, not in this ridiculous, crazy ethanol type way, but, you know, to produce food.
Matt, we've got it. We've got a lot on the table here. We appreciate your call. Bruce Babcock, begin to look at these pieces with us. First, we've got an organic farmer who does it almost in the city on a much smaller scale, but says guys like me can be important in addressing food prices and supply. We've got a sweet potato farmer who says, you know, too much attention paid to you corn farmers out there. We need to look at starches and in other directions. What do you say, Bruce?
Well, with regards to the organic farmer, you know, the United States and Europe and the rich countries have the luxury of being able to choose. Can they pay more for food that is locally produced, that is maybe less efficiently produced, but they have quality attributes they want? That's the beauty of being rich, I guess, the advantage of being rich. You can make those choices. But for most of the world, they rely on efficient mass production of commodities to keep that price low. And what all I can say is, at these price levels, we are running a great experiment to figure out, in fact, how much more can we produce at the and I think over the next year or two, as we see more investment take place, more adoption of modern technology, more food produced per acre, I think that in fact we will see prices come down. So again, I think at high energy prices, you will see people innovate and try everything possible to maximize return to their land, be it sweet potato, be it different kinds of starch. I think that we will see innovation take place, and I think the high prices breed innovation and breed adoption of new technologies.
Lester Brown, a great experiment underway, Bruce Babcock says, from the breadbasket here. Food technology and cultivation has stepped up in the past. There was a time when, you know, several decades ago, people said there's no way it can keep up with the explosion in global population. It more or less has. Can we experiment, on this again and step up in a way that meets the challenge?
I quite agree with Bruce that it's a huge experiment. And the problem is we don't know exactly where it's going to come out. We do have a study from from a couple of faculty members, a couple of professors at the University of Minnesota, who've looked at the effect of ethanol on world hunger. And I think it was about 4 years ago, they did a projection showing that the number of hungry people in the world, which was about 800 million at that time, would drop to 600 million by 2025. Mm. Their most recent study that was published in Foreign Affairs back in the early 2007 shows the number of hungry people going from 800 million to 1.2 billion, a very substantial increase. And this price increase for low-income people, actually, when we look at the 2 billion poorest people in the world, they typically spend somewhere around half of their income on food. So if food prices double, for example, as they have for some of them, I mean, this is difficult. And what we're beginning to see, and particularly in food aid programs that have budgets fixed a year ahead of time, is a dramatic decline in food aid as a result of the rise in commodity prices.
Well, a great experiment, and we are in the middle of it right now, seeing where prices have gone, wondering where they'll go. Bruce Babcock at Iowa State University, keep those farms producing because it sounds like the world needs it. Thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
And Lester Brown at the Earth Policy Institute in Washington. Lester, author most recently of Plan B 3.0, Mobilizing to Save Civilization. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
Tom, thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.